Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 6th, 1998. In the Creekside room this afternoon is Bruce Berner. It's session number 98-5, and it's titled, Kids with Guns in School. Now that you put it that way, Johnny, I'll be happy to change your algebra grade. Let's listen in.
Bruce Berner, and I teach law at Valparaiso University in the School of Law there. I teach criminal law and procedure and evidence and, of course, in accident law. What we'll talk about today probably is closer to what we talk about in the criminal law course than anything else. But before we do that, I know that some of you are not going to be here the whole time that I'm here. I had some sessions last week. I'll have some more sessions this week. I want to just give you a quick rundown of what they were and what they will be. And I'm willing to talk about any of them. One of the things here is you can't always get to all the sessions. But I still have all the material from last week. And if people want to engage in conversation, we can do that. The pretense, of course, is that I'll be able to give you some information. The trick is that I'll be getting information because many of these subjects are so open that we need as much input as we can give. I talked last week, first of all, on a session I entitled OJ, Au Pair, Oh My, which is just a kind of a review of the American criminal justice system and how it works and what steps we take. We talked a little bit about the OJ case. We didn't get to talk too much about the Au Pair case, but I'm happy to do that any time. Then we talked over the question, who killed Princess Di? And I think we ended up with the conclusion that a lot of people did. We can talk about the drunk driver, we can talk about the state of the bridge under which they went, which didn't have appropriate guardrails, we can talk about the paparazzi, we can talk about the newspapers that buy their pictures, we can talk about the people who like to look at those pictures, which make it marketable to make those kinds of magazines. So I had subtitled that when I accuse you. That is, if you're part of the population that likes that kind of reading material, there's a sense in which you're part of the causal chain there. Then we talked on why didn't the judge let the jury hear the really important stuff. This frustrates a lot of people. They know something about the case, they know something is true, but they know the jury never hears it, and so that they think the result is somehow skewed. So we talked about that. And then finally, last week I did a session called So You Want to Be a Lawyer, which simulated a class in law school. In fact, on that day, we built a case from ground zero, a little negligence case about a woman who got hurt in the mall, and looked at some of the things a lawyer does to get ready for the case, how the lawyers for the woman hurt would operate, how the lawyers for the mall would operate, et cetera. This week we have five sessions because we don't have the 4th of July, so we have the full complement. Today is Kids and Guns in School, which we'll talk about in just a second. Tomorrow I'm doing another simulated law school class called a homicide primer. I'm making it real clear that this is not how to commit homicide. It's not that kind of a how to do it course. It's the legal theory that goes into homicide. And since that's one of the things that you read so much about in the papers, and so much of television crime drama is about homicide, you know, because that's the sexiest crime, of course. So we'll work a little bit with some of the basics there. Wednesday, we're working a little bit with law as it is understood by lawyers and law as it is understood in the Bible. And I have a little piece there that I've written, which imagines the giving of the Ten Commandments happening at a different point in time, and that is the point in time after Moses has graduated from law school. So what would the conversation between God and Moses sound like if when Moses received the law, he was already a lawyer? Well, that's on Wednesday after dinner. Then I'm off Thursday. On Friday, I have a little class called Crime and Punishment, Rascals Other Than Raskolnikov, and we'll look at punishment in the American criminal system. What is the theory of punishment? What are we trying to do when we punish people? Is it working? I have some statistics there which basically paint a pretty grim picture of whether or not punishment works, depending on what you think it does. And then finally on Saturday, a little session on tort reform. This would be accident laws, automobile accident, and other things. I think it's safe to say that within the next 15 or 20 years, there are going to be major changes in the way in which we administer these kind of claims, the way people seek compensation for accidental injury. And you're going to see a different kind of insurance and a different kind of system. We've already instituted new systems for the way we do products liability and some other things, but we're going to see some similar things in automobile cases and in torts general. Now, what I would like to do here real quickly before we start with kids and guns is go around and have everybody just introduce themselves very quickly, name where you're from and what you do, and then we'll kind of see what kind of overall sort of occupational resources we can bring to the conversation. Would you mind starting, sir?
William Gladney, St. Paul physician.
Wonderful. There you go. Jim Hussard, Charlotte, Washington, dare I say it, a lawyer.
All right, more than one lawyer in the room. So there will be an argument, right?
We'll both be busy,
right.
Debbie Hussagen from Puyallup, Washington, teacher.
Teacher? Grade school, high school?
Kindergarten.
Well, we hope you haven't had this problem yet in kindergarten, but it's coming down the line.
Yeah. Barb Stranimo, I'm from St. Cloud, Minnesota, and a pediatric nurse practitioner.
Other healthcare professionals, wonderful.
Linda Murray, Mount Brazen, Indiana, kindergarten
teacher. And long-suffering kindergarten teacher.
Long-suffering. Yeah. Gretchen Lenny, St. Paul, Minnesota, retired nurse.
Carol Chris, from Dallas, Oregon, special education teacher.
Group of teachers.
Stan Foster, I'm a law school dropout, and we own and operate apartments.
Okay.
Adam Davis, I'm a college student and from Minneapolis.
We go to college, Adam.
St. Olaf College.
St. Olaf. There's a few of those.
There's a couple.
There's a couple of those. I will start here in a couple of places.
Ed Ferguson from Yakima, Washington. I'm a social service agency administrator.
Dave Peterson from Dallas, Oregon, and I'm a pastor.
I'm Karen Peterson. I'm from Dallas, Oregon, and I work with middle school and high school kids as a substitute teacher.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Do you have any experiences with this? Mm-hmm. You have. Good.
Melanie McQuaig from Wenatchee, and homemaker and volunteer.
Thank you.
Gloria Foster, Wenatchee, an RN in the operating room.
Mm-hmm. Rick Starkweather, Los Angeles, management consultant.
What kind of consultant?
Management consultant.
Right.
Morgan Larson from Minneapolis, a retired telephone instructor. Instructor in telephone, U.S. West.
Who needs instruction in?
Well, they need instruction in everything, lots of things. That's what the operators
I was playing with golf with three friends about 10 years ago, and we picked up this fourth and said, what do you do? And he said, I'm the head of the complaint department for the telephone company, and we all decided he must be very busy, and very, very seldom can he get out to the so you're a telephone instructor.
Right, yep.
Okay.
Instructor. I'm Vernon Anderson. I'm retired and used to work for Boeing. I live in Bellevue, Washington.
Dick Starkweather from Detroit, Michigan. Used to work for Ford Motor Company.
Bob Lilly, Seattle. Used to be a social service administrator.
Virginia Greenwald, director for Lutheran Office of Public Policy in California. So I'm in Sacramento.
So is this something your office is?
Yeah. Big time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ellen Anderson from Bellevue, Washington, homemaker and volunteer.
Thank you.
Letty Deaker, Anacortes, Washington, retired RN.
Thank you. A lot of healthcare professionals, a lot of teachers. Social service agency people, pastors, substitute teachers, who always sort of get the worst of it, don't they? We used to lay for substitute teachers when I was a...
I know how to handle kids like that.
We would handle all kinds of things, which were the... Do they still sit in the wrong seats and can't figure out the seat?
And then I go over and I whisper, next time you change seats, do it with someone that's not getting in trouble.
Okay. Let me just talk a little bit about the sort of legal context within which the kids in school problem works, at least in those cases where the kids actually act out the threats and pull the gun and brandish it, and then of course the worst kind of case where they actually use it and produce a death. We've seen a spate of those in the last year. It's not a new problem. There are some cities that have experienced this for a long time. We get our television news from Chicago, and they could pretty much put this on the news every night. Someone is getting shot either on the way to school or actually in school almost every day. I don't suppose it is every day. But at some point in time, in a city that size, it loses its news value. And so what happens is where we get it is when it happens in places where it usually doesn't happen, or when there are multiple killings, or when very young children do the killings, because then we think, oh, suddenly there's a problem. But of course in this area there isn't suddenly a problem, there's always been a problem. It's just that it's been punctuated over the last years with some very, very unusual situations. Of course, not all of the schoolyard killings are done by kids, right? We had a very bad one in suburban Chicago about five years ago, which was by an adult. In fact, an adult who had been a teacher, and she came back and shot up the schoolroom. But when the killing is done by school children themselves, then I think we start to take notice in a different sort of way. It presents different legal problems. It presents different social problems. But more than anything else, I think it troubles us in a way that when adults act out doesn't trouble us. So one of the things I want to talk about just briefly is how the law, and in particular the criminal law, has tended to deal with the problem of age. Under what circumstance does someone's young age actually constitute something like a defense? Not so much to say that it's right to engage in this behavior, but that it's inappropriate to trigger the criminal law, and what we need to do is to look at some other system to deal with the problem. The 19th century way of dealing with age, and we get this from Great Britain, adopted in the United States up till the end of the 19th century with the advent of the American juvenile system. What the English did and what we did up till the end of the 19th century about age was to say, until a child reaches the age of 7, whatever the child might do, however much trouble the child would cause, we have an irrebuttable presumption of incapacity. What we mean by incapacity is incapacity to commit a crime. It may be antisocial, it may be this behavior, it may wreak an awful lot of damage. But it was felt that it was inappropriate to trigger the criminal system because the criminal system rested on some understandings of what punishment was and what it was for, and that didn't make sense at that point to someone who was under 7. From 7 to 14 was the tricky age, at least for the sort of common law or 19th century position. We knew that once they were past 14, we would assume that they were capable of committing crime. And those kids grew up a little faster there. That is, it was an earlier point where we decided to say anything you do after that, you're going to be treated just like an adult for criminal law purposes. The penalty may be different, and at the sentencing stage, we might take that into account. But in terms of guilt, we would say once you reach 14, then you're an adult for that purpose. That left the tricky age, 7 to 14, and those were handled on a kind of a case-by-case basis. There was a presumption of incapacity, but the prosecutor could come in and try to show that this person had sufficient experience to be responsible for his or her actions. As you could imagine, the lawyers in the room will appreciate this device, this was a presumption that began at age 7 being very strong, and then it was called a slowly reducing presumption. So the presumption got weaker and weaker. So if you had a 13-year-old, you may not have to say a lot to get the 13-year-old treated as an adult, whereas if you had an 8-year-old at the other end of the spectrum, you'd have to come up with a lot of facts. So it was a kind of a presumption that vanished incrementally over a period of those 7 years. None of this had any idea that there was any other official government judicial system that you could put people through. What happened to these people who are incapable, or for whom we couldn't overcome the presumption of incapacity? They simply weren't dealt with by the legal system at all. They were dealt with by other systems. Like what? What other institutions might help?
Why is homes like Boys Town?
Those kind of things, yeah. Either private or public institutions that were sort of made to deal with them. Those are actually a fairly late development.
What about a mental institution?
Yeah, if there were any indicators of mental illness, then there may be then the healthcare side might take over, right? So we get some kind of mental health going there. Also, again, not too terribly far advanced by the end of the 19th century, but certainly beginning.
Juvenile courts?
Weren't until right around in the late 1880s, early 1890s is when we sort of begin to shift to this system. But the juvenile court system didn't exist there. And up until then, it didn't need to exist, because there are other more natural ways of dealing with the problem. Family, church, community. So there are all of these private spheres that would find ways of taking care of the problem. And of course, early communities, what's the big way that the early community would take care of terrible offenders?
Just get them out.
I mean, you'll notice there's no building here that I've been able to find which is called the Holden Judicial Court System. There's no place where you go to have a trial. If you act out, you leave. That's all. You know, it's just we'll send you somewhere else to deal with. Yes, sir.
There was a jail.
Was it?
The lift was the jail.
Okay. But it was surely seen as a temporary
holding facility. So the sheriff's deputy got here, no doubt.
Okay. Yeah, just so long, because we have to kick you out in an orderly way. You don't want to throw people down the Lower Railroad Creek Trail and hope they come out at the other end, right? So you have to take a certain amount of care. But yeah, it was just holding till then. That's interesting. Down on the lift.
More often used as a drunk tank.
I was going to say, it probably was just a drunk tank.
There's liquor to hold? The table.
It's
a long time ago.
There's still liquor.
I don't want to talk about. Did they get it at Sahikan then too? Or?
Yeah. Probably more Cairo.
The 20th century way of dealing with this mainly is a response to two things. First of all, what was generally perceived to be the failure of these other institutions like church, family, community sort of based efforts. One thing, and secondly, some growing literature about how to deal with juveniles who were problems, and so the government basically took it over. Eventually, of course, you know, in the United States, almost all problems find a way to end up move toward a governmental solution, and this was one of the early examples. And the government takes it over by creating a second court system called the juvenile system. Pretty much develops in each state at roughly the same time, a little bit later in some states than in others, but by the beginning of the 20th century, there's something in almost every state operating. The history of it is kind of interesting, but it's built on the notion that it's not about punishment. That was the key distinction, was that the juvenile system is not driven by concepts of punishment, but by concepts of discipline, of reform, education, etc. In other words, the idea was, if we can get people at this age, if they show some misconduct tendencies, put them through a system where they're nurtured and taught and where the bad influences are removed, maybe we can prevent them from being a problem in the criminal system when they grow up. One of the interesting spin-offs of that is because the system is not supposed to be about punishing, but supposed to be about helping, it begins to take on a flavor where there are no due process protections. Where you could go into juvenile court, and I saw this, the big case came in 1967, when all of this was changed. And by that point, people were being, in effect, convicted in the juvenile system with no witnesses, no lawyer, no nothing. The case which went to the Supreme Court, Jerry Galt was 15 years old. He had made some phone calls that were, they weren't obscene. They were just sort of annoying sorts of phone calls. You know, when I don't know if you did it, maybe you were all great kids, but when I was a kid, we made annoying phone calls, you know. Call at 1 o'clock in the morning, is Harry there? Call at 2 in the morning, is Harry there? Call at 3 in the morning, is Harry there? There's nobody but Harry there. And then call at 4 and say, this is Harry, any messages, right? Jerry did that. Well, Jerry did something sort of along those lines, right? They bring him into a court before the juvenile judge. The juvenile judge says, look, I'm not your judge. Don't look at me as your judge. Look at me as your dad. I'm kind of your dad, Jerry, and we're here to help you. So why don't you just tell us what you did? This lady says you made these phone calls. Now, you know, Jerry said, what lady? Well, she doesn't have to come. See, this isn't a real trial, so we don't swear witnesses in, and you don't have lawyers. Tell us what happened, and you'll feel better. So Jerry told him what he did, and he didn't feel better because he was put away for 6 years. And he was put away for 6 years for an offense which, had he been an adult, was a maximum of 30 days by statute. Well, I got the Supreme Court's attention because they said, wait a minute, this system was built on the idea that it's not punishment, right? It's helping, but it's reached the point where it appears to be meeting out punishment. But the initial idea wasn't that it would be helpful. Now, I put these numbers up here. I want to talk a little bit about them. They're different in each state. Okay. Each state writes its own juvenile system. This is not a national system. This is not a federal idea. Each state creates its own set of juvenile courts. They now have more due process. You're entitled to have a lawyer there, etc. And most of them are structured along these lines, although the ages will vary from state to state, and we're going to see in a minute that they're changing now within states. But the basic pattern for the first half, at least, of the 20th century was, from 0 to 14, all misconduct by the individual would be dealt with by the juvenile system. It would never go into adult criminal court. It didn't matter how bad the behavior was, all the way up to homicide. which is, of course, the worst case in the kids in school problem, always went to the juvenile system. The juvenile system's limit of dealing with that person was until age 21. Okay? So Jerry was 15. He got sent away for 6 years for making some silly phone calls. But the flip side of that is if someone is just prior to 13, all you can do, even if they commit multiple murders, is to deal with them for the 7 years from 14 to 21. 18 and up, all of the states say that we will try the person as an adult criminal offender. We don't make any distinctions in these states under 14 or over 18. I've met some 12-year-olds that are 37. How did you? In terms of what they know about the world and this and that. Now, emotionally they might be, but in some ways they seem to us to know an awful lot. It doesn't matter. These are hard and fast rules. Up to age 14, juvenile system, no adult criminal system. After 18, no allowance. No allowance. In other words, you are treated as an adult for all criminal law purposes. It may be that if you have a mental disease that reaches the point where it's insanity, we can talk about that as a separate theory, but you get no more age defense after 18. The problem group is in the middle, and I mean problem for the way the system has to deal with it. Notice both of these systems have one thing in common. It has an age bracket that it's nervous about. It has an age bracket that it wants to ask closer questions before it decides whether this is an adult for criminal law purposes or a juvenile. And that's called waiver age, juvenile with waiver age. These cases start in the juvenile system. But the prosecutor may ask for the juvenile to be waived out. It may be different. Right? The child's interest may be quite opposed to the community's interest in how we answer that question, and yet the statute almost always says you decide this in the best interest of the child and the best interests of the community. And then there are a series in almost every state in the statute of things that the judge looks to. Some of those things are, well, what would you think would be important in deciding whether someone between these ages should be moved out of the juvenile system into the adult system? Yes, sir.
Past offenses.
Past offenses is key, right? In other words, do we have a sort of a chronic pattern here of someone? Because if there are past offenses, those people usually have already been in the juvenile system. They've had some kind of contact with that system. Some help has been tried. And it begins to look, when we get this chronic, that this system doesn't have enough bite to work. And sometimes the truth is that the system doesn't have enough money to work. Right? We're just not willing to commit enough person power and money power to that system to make it work. Many of these systems are very good at having a lot of show emotions and buildings, but not a lot happening inside, not enough people to make them work. And then the danger is that they turn into just warehouses, right? And we warehouse juveniles instead of warehousing adults. And then we wonder why it doesn't work.
We create a system to train the fledgling delinquent into higher levels of performance because they're put in with worse offenders.
Yeah, we are real careful to keep the juvenile population and the adult criminal population separate. But the studies indicate that the juvenile system is also what's called criminogenic. That is to say that it does have this habit, when people get into it, that we get these repeater patterns. It's real hard to know, though, and statistically to tease out whether that's a result of the sort of punishment regime they're in, or whether we're just dealing with people who have this propensity to start with, because even if we have an offender that we don't catch and commits these antisocial acts 1, 2, 3 times, that person still has a high statistical likelihood of repeating the behavior, even though he hasn't been subjected to the punishment part of the system. So that's kind of hard to tease out. What's now happened in most states is we're beginning to manipulate these ages, really. Two things are happening. First of all, the states are beginning to take this number and drive it down. So it's not at all, it was 14 in almost every state for years and years and years. It's not uncommon now to see this go down to 13 or to 12 for all offenses. And then the second thing that happened, and this started about 15 years ago, is many states said for the most serious crimes, like murder, we're going to have a different waiver age. Instead of going 14 to 18, a lot of states started to put in numbers like 10 to 16 is waiver age, and 16 and up automatic adult criminal court for murder. So a lot of states now are sitting at 10 for homicide. Pennsylvania is at 7. Two and a half years ago, the state of Pennsylvania tried a 9-year-old for murder. They actually held a trial. His name was Cameron Coker. And the facts of the case were that he had a gun. We don't know where he got the gun, but he got a gun, and he was shooting it off. And a little 7-year-old girl went by on a snowmobile, and he killed her. We don't know exactly if it was an accident or if it was on purpose, but he was 9. The state of Pennsylvania chose to try him for murder. There was a lot of early coverage in the case. He had a hard time communicating with his lawyer, as you might expect. The lawyer reported that he mostly tugged on the sleeve and asked when he could go home. He said to the lawyer, when the judge asked him what he thought about this, Cameron, who was 9, said, I think that if you don't think about it, you won't be sad. That kind of thing. When that case came out, I wrote a little piece in our university magazine about it. But before I did that, I talked with some child psychologists, and I talked with teachers of 3rd and 4th grade, which is about a 9-year-old, and their reaction was uniform. What's the state of Pennsylvania thinking about when they do this? But that's what happened. I tried several months later to run that case down and could never find how it turned out. Does anyone here recall hearing how it turned out? My best guess is that the case got taken off the track, okay? That it never actually went to trial. If it had gone to trial, you'd be able to find records of it. My guess is they diverted that case probably into the juvenile system because they probably figured out at some point in time that it didn't make sense to them. One of the things that I think, and then I'll open it up. A lot of people who talk about this and who want to convict people regardless of their age very quickly, what they say is, well, the people that they kill are just as dead. Whether you're 12 years old or 30 years old, the victims are just as dead, the pain is just as much, and that's true. The problem is that our understanding of serious crime has always been that serious crime is not just an act, it's not just behavior. Serious crime has always been defined as the combination of a particular act with a particular state of mind. The old Latin, here's $75 an hour if you know the Latin, right? Actus reus, guilty act, plus mens rea, guilty mind. That was always the classic definition of crime, is the doing of a prohibited act with a bad state of mind. What do we mean by a bad state of mind? Usually things like intent, malice, sometimes it's recklessness, sometimes it's knowledge. But it's not just doing something and causing a result, it's doing it for sort of a malicious purpose. And that, of course, is what gets called into question with children, is whether they have the mind which is formed enough yet and where it makes sense for us to say you made a bad choice. I think all of the defenses to crime. First of all, let's start with this. The system absolutely depends on having an image of human beings as people who operate with free will. That's an absolute rock bottom. If it didn't, if we had a deterministic view of human beings, then none of this would make much sense, right? But look at all some of the classic defenses. Self-defense. We call that a defense of justification. Well, the people who kill in self-defense are killing on purpose. But what we're saying is that's a justified choice, right? But we still understand it as a choice, but we, in a sense, approve the choice. As a matter of fact, we say, better that you kill the guy attacking you than that you get killed. Right? We're making that kind of implicit trade-off. Other defenses we call the defenses of excuse and not justification. That is, we're not happy you did it, but we have sufficient amount of understanding of what played on your mind, of what forced your will in one direction. And the best one there to typify that is the defense of coercion. When people are forced in highly pressured situations to act in a particular way. Then we get down to the capacity defenses, like insanity. What are we saying when we say, when we acquit someone based on insanity? We say they didn't have the right equipment to choose. It's not fair. It makes no sense. It's cruel to punish them for a choice when the equipment for making the choice wasn't operating properly with them. We're going to talk later in the week a little bit about insanity. I know that's a very controversial thing, too. And then the defense of infancy, which is the other capacity defense, has historically started with the notion that up to a particular age, the children don't yet have the sort of moral sense to make these choices in a sensible way. And I know, I think probably some of the child psychologists and psychiatrists here and people in social service agencies can give us a lot about some of the Piaget and other experiments to sort of tell us when moral awareness really sets in, and because there's an age at which it just isn't there, right? Is there a sort of a rule of thumb on when the sense of moral responsibility first measurably appears in any integrated way? The stuff I read was long ago, it was 9 at that time, 9 or 10 when Piaget said it sort of kicked in. But interesting, he tested this with stories, wonderful little stories, and you could tell from how Sally accidentally knocks over the big jar, and it breaks, a very expensive jar. Timmy intentionally takes and hides and breaks maliciously the little jar that didn't cost much. Who's worse? Well, the big jar, it's more expensive. Well, until a certain point where they see that, no, it has to do with the motivation behind the breaking that affects too, and that was usually around 9 when that shift started to occur. Comments, questions? Let me ask a couple and ask you to respond to either one. What's causing it? That is, can we identify what's going on in society so that we have this current, what seems to be a little bit of a spike in schoolyard killings? Although, again, I want to make it clear that there's always that baseline. It's always been going on. But what's the current spike coming from? And secondly, what are we not doing about it that we ought to? Because what the legal system basically is doing with it is struggling with it. And they're struggling with it under this particular framework. My guess is that when everything is said and done, it's not mainly a legal problem. It's mainly a social problem, and it needs everybody's sort of input to make it work. Yes, sir.
A couple things. Certainly the increased availability of guns. Hard to shoot someone. Secondly, lack of parenting. Nobody's home. It's quite a lot in most homes. That's a fairly recent change. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting that in the last 4 of these really highly publicized cases, there was 1 year in Oregon,
one in Pennsylvania, which was the prom night sort of spree, and one Mississippi, one in Arkansas. I was there before. What I found interesting was that in some of those cases, it appeared that the parenting had been pretty good. At least what you read in the paper, which I know is always the Oregon case, where the parents are the first victims, as I recall, seemed to be a case where the parents were trying many things to help, right? What you're saying is, as a general rule, we may have a parenting problem and availability of guns problem. Let me ask the school teachers, what's the evidence of the availability and the presence of guns in school? Are any statistics on it or a particular... Now, have you seen guns in the hands of kids in school?
I know kids that have been expelled or suspended because they've had weapons, yeah. Mm-hmm.
By the way, that's an interesting one. Why are schools so quick today to expel students with guns? That didn't used to be so.
I think it's public pressure, isn't it, Marty?
Yeah, I think it's public pressure. I think it's our fault too. I think it's the lawyer's fault because if you don't, and if that kid causes trouble, lawyers are always looking for defendants, and school systems make much better defendants than 14-year-old kids. So, I mean, part of their response is to protect themselves. Right. I just don't ever recall seeing a gun in school when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And they just weren't there. And if I had wanted one, I wouldn't know where to go to get one.
Yeah, it was knives years ago.
Yeah.
Kids went to school.
Yeah,
switchblades. I never saw a gun in school growing
up. I saw a lot of fights, fist fights. Never produced a weapon, you know, it was always out in this one lot, and they'd go at it until they were both kind of bloody, and that was it.
Yeah. I never actually saw the fist fights because I was always had my back turned at that point. Yeah. I'm pretty sure they were going on behind me. Yeah.
But isn't the defense of that the exact same thing, is that the kid really doesn't understand, doesn't have the capacity, and that the fist fight and the gun fight is exactly the same thing? And that the fist fight, it's all about who wins and the domination, and the gunfight is all about who wins and the domination, and the simply using a gun is no more worse in the kid's mind. At least it's the defense I've heard. It's right. No more worse in the kid's mind than punching the kid in the nose. That's how the kid sees it. He doesn't see the consequences. The gun has the exact same consequence as the fist, except it's just the next elevation.
Yeah, and then you get this whole problem also of the lack of a boundary between a fantasy world and the real world.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry to say it, but I love violent movies. They're fun to watch, and I don't want to blame it on the media because I don't think it's the media's fault, but I do think the media has shed some responsibility, and I think the fantasy tends to become a little... intrudes on the real world a little easier nowadays with movies like, you know, kid movies like Mulan, which has come out this summer, which is all about a glorious warrior who kills for the glory and she's the good guy. So I think the fantasy line becomes a little less clear nowadays.
Are you referring also to like Friday the 13th kind of movies?
Well, yeah, I think there's a lack of consequence. There's a lack of coherence when the kid doesn't understand that what happens in movies,
right?
You know,
dead is dead.
Dead is dead, but I don't think they really understand that.
Yeah,
you don't run six blocks after your shot if you're doing the movies.
Yeah.
Well,
and you don't get shot six times, and you're still, you know,
right.
You get shot once, and you're kind of ungraciously fall down.
But I mean, we've had for a long time, we've had Roadrunner cartoons and cartoons of similar ilk where people have steamrollers run over them and then they're up three frames later, right? So you get a little bit of that, although these are more graphic, certainly.
Well, but, and I don't think, and that's what I'm saying, is I don't think the media is at fault for that. I think that, you know, these kind of cartoons and those ideas have been around for a long time. But I think the accessibility, I don't want to blame the accessibility. I think it's a whole conglomeration, but I think the accessibility comes as...
I think the culture, too. I mean, there's a lot of rage in our society. And, you know, and a lack of skills to play out that in nonviolent ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we don't do well in teaching nonviolent creative resolutions of problems. We don't do it.
Yeah, we don't do it.
I mean, if we live in a culture where the death penalty is part of our culture, and that's a very violent act. That is, you know, that's not much of a nonviolent resolution.
Right. The death penalty, by the way, in these cases, even though we can convict all the way down to whatever this number is in the individual state, and 10 is sort of where most states are now, down from 14 or 12, but a few states, even though we can convict of murder or manslaughter, any of the variants, the Supreme Court has said you can't deliver the death penalty to someone unless they committed the act after they were 16. So they've used the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment clause to say, even though you can convict and you can punish with incarceration, including life in prison, the death to be eligible for the death penalty, you have to be 16 at the time. Which sounds to me like a kind of a fudge, right? We're trying to finesse this by saying a certain amount of punishment seems appropriate, but not all punishment. Where's the rage coming from? I notice it too. I mean, I think we all notice that the rage quotient is generally high. That leads to both to more antisocial acting and then to a more vengeful attitude about the people who are acting antisocially. Where is it coming from? I read an article that said they had taken a survey in California that over 50% of male drivers stated in a questionnaire that when they were cut off on the highway by another car, they felt like killing the driver of the other car. I mean, that's just sort of foreign to me. I'm just sort of happy I wasn't hit and go on from there. But where is that?
I just going back to juveniles. I don't know about adults, but in juveniles, and my agency has several residential facilities for juveniles. Almost every one of them who end up in one of our facilities, there's a serious parenting problem, very serious. And it's not surprising that the kids are angry, that there's nobody at home.
So it's not so much ineptness, it's absence.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's nobody at home. And parents, we're all in such a rush to live out the American dream, but in the last 20 years, the age at which parents will leave young people at home to fend for themselves after school has gone down consistently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see 12-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 10-year-olds, you know, even kids as young as 6 or 7 being left at home for extended periods of time after school. And to me, and no one checking up on that, to me, it's almost like they don't have any guidance at all. And when we, the state, refers these people to us, sort of, we have vulnerable facilities and law enforcement, if they don't need to be locked up, they deliver them to us. Mm-hmm. The kids have problems, but we can't solve them unless we can get the parents in and teach them how to be better parents, and that's what most of our effort goes into. And I don't think this is limited to any economic group. I think it's across the board.
The other pattern that we see
and I was talking to a friend that gets a lot of statistics from the Chicago police. One of the things that they see a lot of is this. You'll have a 21-year-old or a 19-year-old, and that person is captain a group of kids running drugs, and these kids are 12, 13, sometimes 7 and 8. They've got these kids doing all the running, and they give these kids guns and tell them they can use them, and if they don't use them right or if they don't get the drugs sold, these will shoot these guys, and they make them aware of that. They know that some of these are too young to have any kind of criminal responsibility anyway. The system might just turn them around, and they tell them that. And that's an interesting question. These kids are now acting in knowledge that they can't be dealt with by the system. But the legal answer to this is simple. The legal answer to this is the easiest thing in the world. Convict these guys. They're directing them to do it. The problem is, you can't figure out who they are. It's like any other kind of organized system. The 21-year-old who's at the top has never talked directly to them. This is always happening through different sorts of intermediaries, so you can't get back to them. And so these are the ones often that end up with them. Now, that doesn't appear to have been true in the schoolyard cases, but it's true a lot in some of the inner city shootings that go on, that these are being directed by.
It sort of sounds like the mafia younger. I mean, that's the way the mafia worked, was.
Sure.
The reason the little ones are willing to do what those 21 and 19-year-olds are saying is because no one's at home.
Yeah,
and they are
right.
Looking for love.
Right.
They're looking for somebody to tell them to be with them and be their friend and be their
absolutely.
Bro. They're on your homeboy, on with, oh. with you. And
oh,
they
wow.
want that desperately.
Right. That's right.
And they're willing that's to carry that gun around if that 21-year-old is going to kind of be a parent and kind of be the, he's my homeboy, you know, he's going to be there for me. But as soon as they hit juvenile systems, they never get visited by their homeboys. There, that's it. If you get caught, that's too bad.
Right. A couple of things. One of them is, yeah, the 21-year-olds know which ones down here to recruit, because they're looking for the ones that need to belong, that don't have any support system. It's the way Charles Manson used to pick the people. Right? He could spot the ones he wanted. He knew the ones that were vulnerable, had no support system.
There's lots to pick from right now.
Yes, sir.
There's no one at home to parent the kids in many cases because the wives have been put to work, and some folks who've studied this say our tax laws are in blame. We basically have put the wives to work to pay the taxes. Mm-hmm. 1962, 14% was the average family tax rate. Mm-hmm. It's now in 1998, 42%. And the difference between 14% and 42% tax rate is what the average woman makes mm-hmm. to support the family.
Right.
So we have taxed the American family into putting the women to work so there's no kid support at home. In addition to that, we have a social welfare program that has institutionalized and subsidized single parenthood. In our own little community hospital in Wenatchee, last year, 70% of all the births there were by mothers on welfare. So we have, as a society, unwittingly created this very monster that we're dealing with here.
Yeah. Well, we don't have a welfare system anymore like that, so that's
a... You wait. That's
but they're still having babies.
You
wait. We haven't got that figured out yet.
Yeah. You say it's not there, but what is the media going to do when the fifth year is hit? By those women. There's going to be a frenzy, and there's going to be stories on all the national networks of these poor little middle-class families, you know, struggling mother who's out for welfare and the poor kids starving to death. And you wait and see if, in fact, we will enforce that in the fifth year. I wager that we'll have the bleeding hearts get us right back in the same system.
Yeah, it's hard to look at hungry children and not...
Yeah. Well, when you pay the woman more money, if they have a kid every 2 years, they have a kid every 2 years.
Right. And you take the money away if a man shows up.
You take the money away, those babies stop coming.
If a man shows up, they take the money away.
Yeah, if there's a dad in the home.
Exactly, except that, you know, I mean, we say that, but statistically, like they did, they have put a cap on the births, you know, a cap on the births for the welfare mothers in New Jersey, and that has not proved out. That's just one of the states.
They're still having sex.
Well, in most cases, it doesn't really pay to have a baby for less than $100 for a month. It costs a whole lot more than that. So there's a lot of other things operating besides the income stream.
Beyond the changes in government and all, I think simply the breakdown of the institution of marriage over the last 30 years for a huge number of young people have children and with no intention to get married, and young men feel no responsibility in many cases for those children, which is something new in our lifetimes, all of us, to have that.
And the other problem sort of fits in with what this gentleman was saying that we've seen in our city as well. The cycle of poverty is such that when the mother wants to work but needs child care, the cost of the child care is so high that it doesn't pay her to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
Because all that's the money to pay to work is just turned back to child care. So,
or at least she's got a reasonable alternative. This, you know, the same thing existed in 1930 in the Dust Bowl and Depression. You got in the old jalopy, or you hitchhiked, or you made it to California, or did something to go get a job. But now we don't have that. We have a disincentive for that now. We have an alternative incentive, which is to take the welfare, which will actually pay more net than going to work.
Yeah.
It depends on what state now.
It does depend really on what state.
Yeah, and it depends, because every state has such a different setup that doesn't really fit anymore.
Yes, I think one other factor, I don't know whether it's a bigger or small one, is that our culture becomes more and more mobile.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've stayed in one place for a long time now, but I didn't when I was younger.
Right.
And after nearly 20 years in that one town, it's still hard to reach out for help with parenting. It's still hard to say to, because I'm far away from family. And so if I say to myself, oh God, I wish that somebody would take my kid to the park today. Or, wouldn't I love it if so-and-so from the congregation invited my child to play cards or go biking. But they don't volunteer and I don't ask. And so when I'm tired and grumpy and not an effective parent, we just suffer in silence in our little nuclear family.
Mm-hmm. The mobility is an interesting problem. I've always thought that it might be part of what it used to be. You know, you would be born into a community, you were going to stay in that community, you were going to work there, you were going to die in that community. Once you know that, the way you behave is quite different from the way you might behave if you say, boy, if I burn some bridges, I'll just move three states over.
Yeah.
And so my reputation and protecting my reputation isn't so important if I have this ability to move on once I get my reputation moving.
Anonymity,
Yes, ma'am.
I'd be interested, it's got something to do with America and something about our attitude toward being fiercely independent and guns and all those things tied together. Because we have other countries, the gentleman mentioned that the high taxes mean everybody has to go to work, but we've got other countries that have high taxes, the Scandinavian countries, Germany, high taxes. They don't have as much trouble with juvenile violence as we do. So there's a whole lot of other factors involved.
Well, it's interesting. I'm not sure it's harder to make the case not as much problem with juvenile violence as it is to say with juvenile shooting. England's a wonderful example. There's no guns in England, for the most part. Even the cops don't have guns. I was there for 6 weeks. and this was about 6 years ago, in 6 weeks I saw 5 fistfights on the street. I haven't seen a fistfight in this country for years and years and years. And we know what the soccer sort of hooliganism is that goes with British soccer, but they're not shooting each other because they don't have guns. So maybe the sense we were saying over here before, the violence comes out in a different way, right? And so it's a fist fight. Well, usually people aren't dead at the end of the fist fight.
Right, they can walk away.
Right. And you always knew if there was a Brit and an Irishman, there was going to be a fist fight, you know, and that's what most of them were. But, yeah.
On the subject of all these guns, what is the Supreme Court's rationale for interpreting the Second Amendment in such a way that the entire nation is the militia, and we have this supposedly well-regulated militia? In order to have a well-regulated militia, everybody in the country has to have a gun.
Well, first of all, the Supreme Court hasn't dealt with that itself for over 50 years, and then they only dealt with it as a kind of a footnote. The lower federal courts have now taken that position, most of them. There's one circuit that takes the position that the Second Amendment doesn't mean that. Second Amendment, I think, reads a well-regulated militia being necessary for the common defense, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be violated, right? So one of the questions is, does the first sentence sort of predicate the second? That is, if we could figure out that a well-regulated militia is no longer necessary, right, then do we get away with arms, or are the arms something else? But that's the argument. My problem with the argument is, and one of our colleagues at the law school is a big Second Amendment defender, and an NRA person and everything else, and when you talk to them, they say, it's when the government comes after us, it's for the common defense. And suddenly you picture these guys with muskets.
Yeah. Yes.
And they're behind trees, and they're in Massachusetts, and they have a red bandana, and they're protecting themselves. And really what we have is kids in the inner city with flamethrowers shooting each other. And you wonder, what does the Second Amendment and the militia have to do with that? But no one knows what the Supreme Court will do with it if they take the case. But see, they're in charge of that kind of case, whether or not they even take it. They have kept hands off. They don't want to touch that case because that's so hot.
Because we really, as a citizenry, trying to protect ourselves from a government, we really ought to have nuclear weapons.
That's right.
We ought to have the whole nine yards.
That's right.
If our elected official turns against us, a few guns are not going to do crap.
That's right. An A-bomb is what we need. That's right. Absolutely.
A-bomb in every hole.
That's right. The R's
a perfect way to end at 4:45. An A-bomb in every hole. Thank you all.